Rob, welcome to the podcast. Rob rides EMTB. You're probably best known for creating YouTube videos in the world of e-bikes. Probably some of the highest quality videos out there at the moment. I think a good place to start is how you discovered e-bikes. What got you into the world of e-bikes?
Oh, mate. First of all, thanks for your positive words on the channel. I was always into riding bikes, but not at any kind of level, just for fun, really. Just kind of going out, riding in the forest and just, you know, social rides, those kind of things. But I was never like super into biking. But I started, as I got older, to get a little bit more into biking. So I bought a cross-country bike and then a full suspension bike. And I think the reason that I got into e-biking is because I wanted my wife to ride with me. So we actually bought an e-bike, and it was actually for her, because I thought, you know, she'll maybe enjoy it a little bit more. E-bikes look like they're pretty cool. And this was back in 2018. So what's that? 5 years ago?
Yeah.
So we bought an e-bike, we bought a Specialized Levo. And I remember taking it out for the first time, went to Swinley Forest. I was like, I'm gonna test this. And gave it a run around the forest. And I was like blown away with how good it was. I was like, this is such a good ride experience that this is nuts. So I ended up basically riding it way more than her. And with that bike, I wanted to find a little bit more information about it. So there was nothing really online. There was no... It was still really niche. It was still 2018. It's only 5 years ago, but there was no e-bikes. No one rode e-bikes in the UK, at least. So then I started a web forum for e-bikes, and just kind of it grew from there, really. I was just really curious about... I like the technology side of it. I like the bike side of it. And it was kind of bringing those two things I like together. And I could just see something in this e-bike. I was like, this is seriously good, and there's some future here for e-bikes. So I just got hooked, really, as soon as I had that first go on it. Like lots of people, you know, if they have a first go on an e-bike, they're blown away.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, so that's what happened to me, and I was just hooked since that very first ride.
I think everybody remembers that first sort of spin of the wheels on an e-bike, and it's like that car park ride that you get, like just grab somebody else's bike and have a quick spin. Go on, have a quick spin. And it's like they come back, everyone comes back with the same look on their face, don't they?
Yeah. Yeah, I see it as my kind of like duty now to get people out and give them a go on it, especially if they're skeptics. We had an event in Scotland a couple of weeks ago, and the day after the event, me and my mate went on e-bikes. We just put them on turbo. We thought, right, we've got 2 hours. We pedaled to the top of Glen Tress, and there was a dude that we passed a couple of times. Mm. He was on an old school pedal bike, doing an amazing job. He'd done like 5 days of riding, and he stopped at the top, and we stopped, and he got really kind of into it. He was having a look at it, and we could tell he was super interested. And yeah, he had a go on my mate's Pole e-bike, and he was just, again, he's just blown away with it. He's like, this is crazy. This is, funnily enough, my mate went on the pedal bike and he said, that was horrible. He was like, I'm never doing that ever again.
It's like riding in treacle.
Yeah, his heart was like at 180 BPM. He's like, that was so hard. But yeah.
It's funny to remember back to how it was, and sort of you just took it for granted. A trail bike, an enduro bike, that's how it felt pedaling up a hill. And to go back to that now is quite a painful thing to do. I do it every once in a while. I remember meeting you, actually, possibly the first time I met you. And we did that shoot for Specialized. And I said to you, so how often do you ride a regular mountain bike? You're like, never. And I was honestly shocked. I couldn't believe that you wouldn't choose to ride a regular mountain bike ever. Sure enough, I'm the same as you now. Like I very rarely touch it. Maybe on an uplift, doing an uplift at Antistiniog or somewhere like that. That's about it. Yeah.
I did keep my Stumpy for like a year after I got an e-bike, my own e-bike. And I thought, oh, I'll still ride it. Mm. And honestly, I didn't. I didn't ride it. I think I took it out once in maybe 6 months or so. And I ended up selling it because I thought, someone else can enjoy it. There's no point it sat in the garage. But I found even on just regular boring trail rides, the e-bike was way more fun. You should just put it in turbo and you can just blast along as fast as you like. And, you know, you still get a workout, all of that stuff. And every time since I rode an e-bike that I took a normal pedal bike out, I just found it a little bit more boring personally. So I thought, if I prefer the e-bike, I've got access to an e-bike, I'll just take that out. So
it's fun.
Yeah, I didn't keep it for too long. And that's it really. Like I can't remember the last time. Do you know what? Funnily enough, you can't see because it's off camera. I've got a road bike set up over there and I've got one in my studio as well that I occasionally do some Zwifting on because I do like to do the spin kind of thing and get the heart rate going, but I prefer that stationary rather than being outside.
Yeah. Safer.
Yeah, safer, exactly.
So you mentioned about looking for information online about e-bikes. Obviously, EMTB forums was a place that you really started to make your name for e-bikes. How did that come about?
Yeah, it came about because I was trying to find information on e-bikes, and there was a couple of, I think there was like a German site, German forum. There was nothing in the US, and that was it. And I thought there's going to be more people like me that are trying to find information on e-bikes, reviews, bits of information or other owners or even just photos of them. And people like to geek out on stuff, whether it's cameras or cars or technology. There's all these kind of groups that you can find online, like Reddit and those things, that you can just share info. And I thought there's got to be something out there, and there wasn't. So that's why I started the EMTB forum site. And I had some experience making some similar motorbike community forums. So I did one for Ducati and one for Triumph in the past. So I was like, well, I've done that before. I'll just try and replicate it. And I started the EMTB forum site and, yeah, started off with like maybe 5 people and just grew from there. And that's why I started the e-bike channel, to try and, I thought, well, e-bikes, YouTube's a great place to get reach, to, you know, discover, so people can discover content. And I tried to get people to go over to EMTB forums from the YouTube. And in fact, before it was called Rob Rides EMTB, the YouTube channel was just called, I think it was called EMTB Forums.
Yeah.
And I kind of discovered over time that wasn't very personable. So I since changed the name. But yeah, I think it started in maybe early 2018, and it just grew and became a place for people all over the world to kind of connect and share pictures and share stories and talk about problems that they're having. And it just became a resource for people, I think. And I don't know how many members are on there now. Maybe, I don't know, 20,000 maybe.
Wow.
But there's way more visitors than the members. So if you Google it tends to rank quite high. So if you Googled, I don't know, Specialized Levo Brose Motor or something, it ranks pretty high. So it's still a good place. And I enjoy like participating in it and seeing, again, people getting their e-bike for the first time and going online and being super amazed with the e-bike and sharing their pictures and sharing their stories. So yeah, it's a cool resource, I think.
So the forum was a bit on the side whilst you were still doing your regular 9-to-5 job.
Yeah.
And then at what point did you think it's time to take the leap to actually creating videos full time?
Well, I'd been creating videos, I would say, part time after a few months of starting the forum. So I think I was basically working full time in London, commuting into the city of London, and doing the YouTube and doing the forum stuff on the side. I think it was probably about 18 months after that I thought it could be an option. I thought, look, there's something in this. I think I could do this and definitely take a salary cut. But I thought it would kind of fit in with lifestyle, and we have young children, and meant I could work from home a little bit more. My wife travels away quite a lot for work, and it just kind of all fit, all of the stars kind of aligned, if you like. And I took the took a bit of a leap of faith. And I was in a lucky position that my boss said, look, if it doesn't work out, you can come back. So I kind of thought, oh, like, you don't get many opportunities in a lifetime to try and do something that you really, really love. So it must have been, I think it was 2019 that I left my job, and people were like, oh, where are you going? What company are you going to work for? And I was like, yeah, I'm going to do YouTube. And they were like, what? Because it's still like, you know, I'm 42, and to leave a good company and go and be a YouTuber is quite nuts to a lot of people. Still is when I think about it.
Well, you did what many people say they'd love to do, but never actually take the action. And for you to actually say, this is my dream, I guess, and I want to do it, and you know what, I'm going to do it, that takes some balls, I think. Like, takes some guts.
Yeah, it was really scary. And, you know, it's... I think with it, there was a lot of right place, right time, because e-biking was just at the start. There wasn't really many channels. I think there was EMBN and maybe me, and I think that was it. So, and I kind of had this inkling that e-bikes were going to be big. So I kind of was lucky in that respect that I was just at the beginning of the boom of e-bikes. So yeah, it was, I think some of it was luck and being in the right place at the right time, and kind of just it made me feel like it was a risk that I was willing to take. If it was just kind of leaving and doing some reviews on tech or cameras, there's so many great channels already doing that, so I think it'd be really difficult to find a point of difference and grow quickly. But yeah, with e-bikes there wasn't really a lot online, so I thought, yeah, I can try and do this. And I had that like almost promise from my boss at the time, which was amazing, who said, if it doesn't work out, come back. So I thought, in 6 months, if I've totally screwed up, I can go back.
You seem like a fairly organized person.
Oh man, no, you don't know me.
No? Okay. But was there like an element of planning, and had you sat down with a piece of paper and written down like a business plan almost to say, this is how I want to structure it? This is the kind of what's going to happen in 1 year's time, 2 years time, or was it just a case of let's just see what happens?
Yeah, there was a bit of that. I had an ongoing revenue stream from some of the other bike sites that I had, so I knew that even if I didn't make any money from YouTube, I could still have I could still have a revenue stream coming in. So I knew that I had that, and I kind of had an inkling that YouTube would grow and I'd be able to make it successful. Or, you know, I think that I was confident that it would work. So I had a very vague plan and a list of, you know what you do when you start a YouTube channel, you look for things to do, and it's like, do one video a week, do this, make sure it's consistent. So I had like a rough outline, but I'm not a great planner. I'm not great at creating spreadsheets and kind of long-term plans. I'm a bit more of an in-the-moment type of person, and kind of a bit more short-term. And my plans are kind of more like notes on my iPhone with just little bullet points and things. And yeah, I'm not the best planner, so it's funny that you see me.
I don't know, but you give off that image. Obviously the growth was pretty... I can imagine the first year of growth was slow, and then
slow,
and then you eventually start to see it pick up. How was it creating videos and thinking, wow, I've jumped in at the deep end here, and still you weren't getting that much traction? How did you get through that and to the point at which people were actually starting to watch?
Well, I think, yeah, those first, let's say it was a year of videos, I was still working full time. So it was kind of like a hobby. So I didn't really mind if it didn't really do well. I kind of did it just for fun to start with. Like my first video, I've got loads of kit now, which is cool, and it's grown over the years. But my first video, I didn't even have a GoPro. So I had an iPhone, and I found a chest strap and strapped an iPhone to my chest. Yeah. So they were all kind of for fun. But there was a couple of videos that did really well. And I think one of them was... I think it was like the first Specialized Levo. I did a video on the Levo, And it did like 30,000 views. I was like, whoa, there's people that are really interested in this stuff. So when it was like product focused, I knew that those videos would do quite well. So then I contacted a few local bike shops and said, hey, you've got this bike that I've seen online. Can I come and do a video on it? And if it was a new bike and something quite exciting, they would tend to do fairly well. And then all my rides with me plodding around the forest would just, you know, not do so well. So, the first year of growth is definitely slow. I think to get your first 1,000 subscribers is the hardest thing to do in YouTube. And then to get 10,000 subscribers is hard. But after that, it starts to become easier and easier. So I just thought, right, if I can get 1,000 subscribers, that's pretty decent. There's, you know, that's a lot of people that are saying, yeah, I want to see more videos on this type of content. I can't remember exactly how long it took, but it might have taken like 6 months or so to get 1,000 subscribers. And then to get 10,000, which was the next big milestone, was probably a year, another 6 months. So it shows how quickly things can grow after that. But definitely the first 1,000 was like it was really difficult to get.
6 months to get 1,000 to me seems pretty quick still.
Do you think?
Yeah.
It might not be. I'll have to have a look. But I think it was. I think it was about that. I think it was. Yeah, but that's a grind, man. Sometimes I was doing two videos a week back then.
Yeah.
So I was thinking, you know, and you don't earn much, if any. Well, you don't earn any ad revenue until you get to 1,000 subscribers. So you're kind of doing it all for, yeah, just because you enjoy what you're doing. You're not doing it for the money at that point.
So what sets you apart from other people? Because there's a lot of channels out there that are bike focused. There's also e-bike channels out there. Is it the fact that you focused on product videos as opposed to just lifestyle videos? Is that what gave you the growth? Because you were, I guess you were helping people decide, make decisions on quite big financial sort of decisions in their life.
Yeah, I think so. I think that there's some great channels out there. Some people doing some fantastic work, and there's some great channels from riders as well, and I watch all of them. And I thought that I'm never going to be a great rider. I'm just like, you know, an average rider. But what I thought I could do is I could highlight product and show it at a decent quality, and that was going to be my point of difference. So I'd make sure everything was filmed in 4K, for example, and I try and really feature parts of the bike that I thought I might want to see. So if I'm spending, at the time an e-bike was maybe $6,000, so it's a lot of money, so I'd try and show all the little bits of an e-bike that might not be that interesting to lots of people, but I found it interesting, like how the motor bolts in and all these weird kind of geeky things that I was interested in. I thought there must be other people that want to see this kind of stuff. So yeah, focusing it on the product really worked. And I think that's the case in YouTube in general. Like anytime I'm looking for a camera or a lens or some kind of tech, I'll go to YouTube and or I'll Google it, and a YouTube result will come up right at the top, or a car or anything. So I think that's how we consume or take in information on things now. I can't remember the last time I didn't do that for a product. I think I always, search online. So I thought, yeah, this is, if there's a new product out, people are going to be interested in it, I'll make a video on it.
When I look at the style of your videos, and also when I look at your thumbnails, it most closely compares to a lot of those tech channels out there that are reviewing iPhones or whatever, the latest camera. Did you get some inspiration from those channels? Was that a direction you wanted to go down?
Yeah, for sure. I think that where I worked before, I thought the way that they presented tech was fantastic. So I took some inspiration from how they presented and how they displayed new technology. And then there's some great channels on cameras, and there's some great like tech channels. There's a guy called MKBHD, Marquez Brownlee, who does some amazing tech reviews. He also does car reviews now. He's got a couple of channels. So I looked at what works for them and how they present things and how they take shots of things, how they light things, and I thought that looks really good. I'll try and replicate some of that in what I do.
Mm, you seem to have done a good job of it. Let's talk thumbnails, because thumbnails seem to be such a big part of getting that reach and getting those clicks. And I think Mr. Beast, he found that the thumbnails with his face sort of in the entire thumbnail with his mouth open, sort of in shock, those are the ones that got the most traction.
Yeah.
Did you look and see like what is going to get the most traction?
Yeah, I didn't start really paying attention to thumbnails and titles for a long time. So I would just I would just do that last in the whole video process. So I'd film something, and as it was uploading, I'd be like, damn, I need to, what's my thumbnail going to be and what's my title going to be? But as I started to get more into YouTube growth and try and understand it a little bit more, I watched a couple of podcasts with Mr. Beast on it, and he was explaining how important like thumbnails are and titles are. So yeah, I started to try and do a little bit more work on those and pay a bit more attention. And now when I'm making a video, when I'm making it, I always am thinking about what the thumbnail is going to be and when's going to be a good opportunity to get this thumbnail. And I've done a couple of where I've put my face in. You might have seen if you've looked through. It's proper cheesy, man. It's like, it's the typical kind of mouth open, look at this, point into the product. But it works.
Yeah.
It works. As human beings, we are programmed to look at somebody's eyes on a picture, and we have that instant connection, even if it's subconsciously. If you're looking for a book or a magazine, if there's somebody featured in it, your eyes are instantly drawn to that. And I think it's just programmed into us all as human beings. So those weird, shocked, stupid looking faces in thumbnails actually do work. You can look at click-through ratio, and yeah, if I can get a face in a thumbnail, I try and do it. It's a bit weird with bikes because it doesn't always work, because the shape of a bike's quite long, and it doesn't lend itself to it.
Especially the bikes you ride.
Yeah.
What, pretty long ones.
Yeah. But if it's a product, like I did one with, I think the new SRAM transmission, where I put my face in, and I actually looked at a Mr. Beast thumbnail. I was like, that looks really good. I'm going to try and do something like that. And yeah, the click-through ratio ended up being like really good on that.
Yeah.
Like, yeah. So
it works.
It definitely does work.
Mr. Beast is insane. The growth that he's had. And I love the fact that he basically reinvests all the money from the previous video into the next one. And he rarely takes the profit. I think the most recent one he's trying to shoot right now, he's bought a corner shop, just a grocery store, and he just told a random person, for every day that you spend in this grocery store, I'm going to give you $10,000. And he just put a tweet out saying, this guy won't leave. He's going to bankrupt me.
I'd do that. 10,000. You could live for a pretty long time in a grocery store.
Yeah.
Like all the groceries, obviously. I'd just live on like Muesli for a year or something and pocket the 10K every day.
What if it was a bike shop?
How long could you stay in there for? As long as you've got some supplies and like an internet connection.
Yeah.
Yeah, I reckon you could do quite a long time. That's a pretty easy challenge compared to a lot of his challenges where you've got to stay in a circle or something like that, a very small place in a room. So yeah, that could be quite expensive for him.
Yeah, do you see the Squid Game one?
Yeah.
That was wild.
Yeah.
What do we got next? I saw you did the DJI Osmo. You had a partnership with them. How was it working with a tech company as opposed to a bike company?
Mm. Yeah, I've done a few videos in the past where where people have asked about stuff that I'm using, like what GoPro do I use? In fact, most of the videos, people in the comments will say, that looks great, what are you using? And I try and respond with a comment, but I don't reach them all. So I think I did one on the GoPro, a video on the GoPro when that came out a couple of years ago, and I did one after that, the GoPro Hero 10 or something. So I think DJI had perhaps looked at people that are in specific industries, whether it's biking or surfing, and who has actually done videos featuring action cameras before in any given niche. So that I think they found my channel and they messaged me and just reached out and said, look, do you want to do something? So I used the DJI product anyway. I had the Action 3, which I liked. And then they said, we've got a new one coming. So would you like to feature it on your channel? So that's how that came about. And I thought it's kind of related to what I do. People are interested in it. So that fit. I do get a lot of requests for product that don't quite fit. So I say no to probably like 99% of people that contact me. And it has to have some kind of link, I think, to my channel and my audience for it to fit. And I think the action cameras do, because a lot of people, like even if I just got to my local trails, there's a lot of people that have a GoPro or a DJI and are recording their rides. Whereas if it's like a, hey, Rob, we've got this new tent. Would you like to, doesn't quite, I mean, maybe it does, but it doesn't quite fit as much as an action camera. Mm. I don't do many of them, but I thought that was probably worthwhile.
Obviously, action cameras are great for most YouTubers that are trying to self-shoot. I assume you went from that transition from self-shooting your videos to thinking, oh, I might need to get somebody in now to start to help up the quality, get shots of you riding. How difficult was it to make the transition from just self-shooting to then actually getting somebody in and maybe paying someone to help you create videos?
Yeah. I don't think it was that difficult, because it makes a massive difference to when you're out. Like if you're by yourself, it's infinitely harder, an order of magnitude harder to film, because you've got to set the camera up, put it on a tripod, go and press record, go and find that you're out of focus for that last 10 minutes and reshoot it. So when I found somebody that could help, and it was John, the bike pilot, who we did some social rides with, and he had some history with videography. So he was like, hey, if you ever need anybody, and he said that to me about 5 or 6 times, if you ever need anybody to help. So I was like, oh, this one time I'm going to, yeah, do you want to come and do a shoot with me? And it was massively beneficial. Like, you know, having shot stuff, if you've got somebody to help out, it's a massive help. So the net benefits of having that, like those files and all shot, all in focus, yeah, it was huge. So it was a no-brainer, really, to do that as much as possible.
Yeah, yeah. I found that if I need to shoot something that I know I need somebody else with, I'll get my girlfriend Jen in to help, and it's, you know, one take turns into 2 takes, turns into 3, and then it's like, she's like, I've really got to go now. It's so hard to rely on someone, especially, I don't know about you, but for me, talking to camera did not come naturally, and I still find it difficult. But when you're self-shooting, you plonk the camera there, you're still just, you're on your own, you're in your own environment, it's okay. The minute you put somebody behind the camera, then all of a sudden there's another element of, oh, I've got to think about that now. Did you find it hard talking to camera when you were working with somebody else?
Yeah, I still do all the time. I think that's just a natural feeling. Some people are really good at it and some people are not. I was never a good like public speaker at all. But I found that if I'm filming, I can cut out all the bad stuff that I say. And if I don't like what I've said, it can be edited after the fact. But when there's somebody behind the camera, I always mess up what I'm saying all of the time. But the beauty of editing is you can make it look like that take was amazing and everything you said was correct. So, yeah, I don't think I find it any easier with somebody behind the camera or any harder. It's just the same for me.
Yeah. Let's talk about the more, should we say, toxic part of YouTube, and that's the comment section. Have you found the comment section to be a net positive or negative? Do you sometimes look at, do you get many negative comments, I guess?
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. Mainly on what I'm showing. So if it's an e-bike, you'll occasionally get people coming in saying, oh, why are you on an e-bike, dude? You're not old. Like, you shouldn't be on an e-bike. But I actually like it when that happens, because it means that the video has reached people that aren't necessarily into e-bikes. You've reached a wider audience. So anytime I get comments like that, it's actually, I find it a really good thing. Yeah. Because they're people that haven't ever watched one of my videos before, and they're not, definitely not subscribers. They might even not like e-bikes at all. So that's a really good thing. Whenever I see comments on that, I'm like, yeah, the video's doing quite well. Sometimes you get like personal comments that are a bit annoying, like, oh, you suck, or why'd you do that? And I'm fine with it. It's like the first one that you get is a bit like you feel like, oh man, that was harsh. But after you've got 100 of those, it's fine. And YouTube seems to be doing a good job at filtering out a lot of like hate speech from what I've seen now, you can go into the YouTube studio and there's like potentially, I can't remember the language that they use, but they're really good at filtering out a lot of stuff that might be like personally derogatory or personally offending. So yeah, I'm fine with the comments. I don't really take it. There's a lot of stupid comments out there, but I'm fine with it now.
Out on the trails, I found now that I don't get as many negative comments whilst I'm riding. Most people are either also e-bikers, or those that aren't, they've just kind of grown to accept it.
Yeah.
Many people, I think, have already maybe tried one out and they've seen the benefits of it. Weirdly, the only place that I've experienced negativity this year whilst riding an e-bike was when I rode up Snowdon. And you've got a lot of people there that are not used to the world of bikes. And so when you're asking to, like, excuse me, can I come past? And they move out of the way for you and they go, oh, wow, how are you getting up that? And then they see that you're riding an e-bike and suddenly you get the, oh, chee, and you get those comments that we used to get at a trail center.
Yeah.
Do you think that stigma in the world of bikes, I guess, has gone now?
No, I think it's still going to be there. I think I also experience similar to what you do. If it's somebody that doesn't actually ride themselves, maybe people that are just out for a ride. There's a really steep hill over here, like a super steep hill that takes me to the top of the trail. And on an e-bike, it's doable in about 8 minutes to the top. And occasionally there's people walking past and they will be like, you know, what you got? How are you doing that? And then they're like, oh, cheating, I see. It's cool, man. I don't mind it at all, because that will disappear with time. Like, e-bikes are basically representing a large portion of like the higher end bike sales. So I think that acceptance over time it'll be the norm. And I think that, yeah, I don't think there's many more years that we'll get that kind of cheating or, you know, those weird comments on, oh, you're on an e-bike, why would you do that?
Yeah,
I think that will disappear.
If that growth that they've had in Europe is going to translate to here, I think that you're right. I mean, we do seem to be a few years behind some of the European countries, but the growth is insane.
Yeah,
it's incredible.
Yeah.
One thing that we didn't speak about, which I wanted to touch on just previously, was the equipment that you use. So, I mean, obviously, when you're out riding, you're out in the elements, you need to have quite a lot of kit on you whilst you're riding. What do you tend to carry with you when you're out shooting?
Tech-wise, like kit-wise, yeah. So I think I've gone through quite a few different like cameras and things and different systems, and I think the most important thing is being able to just grab a camera and shoot and it nail focus. You don't have to worry too much about settings, and I don't want to be a camera technician when we're out on the trails because it just takes too much time. So I started off with a Panasonic camera and found that was pretty good, but it didn't really have the greatest autofocus. So I was like, right, autofocus is so important. But shooting bikes is actually really hard because it's a fast moving subject. There's lots of stuff in the way. There's often trees and there's not a huge amount of contrast. Imagine a contrast to that might be a car on a track. It's a big solid subject and it's got a kind of tarmac background, and it's much easier for an autofocus system to focus on that, even though it's fast moving. But a bike in a forest is actually quite difficult for a camera to focus on. So I was like, right, we need some proper kit that's going to work reliably. And I then invested in Sony. So I got an A7S III and started off with a couple of lenses. And then just over time, I found that, okay, I'll need maybe a longer lens. So I bought a longer 70-200 lens that's got great autofocus.
Lovely lens.
Oh, it's amazing, man. Every shot that you get from that, if it's in focus and you can slow it down, it just looks so good. It's such an amazing lens. So yeah, so I invested in Sony and then have just kind of grown the lens collection from there. But that's taken, I don't know, 25 years really. Mm. So I started off just with an iPhone, and then I think I got Panasonic GH5. Yep. That was a really popular camera back then. And then after a couple of years of that, got the Sony because that just worked so well. It's compact, it's full frame, it's weatherproof, and it's been great. It's been everywhere with us. It's survived, and it's got wet mud all over it, like stones hitting the lens. And yeah, it's still going.
Have you found that shooting in the winter months, you start to question why you're doing it?
Yeah, man, it's super harsh. And the thing with winter is it's not just cold and wet. It gets dark at like 3:30. So you've got really limited time for you to be able to actually shoot, which is one of the reasons why I built like a studio space. So in the winter, I can actually do more. I can do bike builds or how to's, or there's another opportunity to get content that doesn't rely on the British weather being good.
Yeah. But the studio to me seemed to be a big shift in your channel. Do you think that the studio really helped the growth of the channel?
Yeah, I think so. I think partly because I could do different content to just being out on the trail. And I kind of used it for bike builds, and even just some of the videos I do, even if it's a bike release video, some of the content will be studio shot. So I'll get maybe some B-roll shots of the bike in it. It just gave a bit more scope to add a little bit of extra content to the shoots itself. And yeah, it's where I sit down and edit, and it's kind of a space that I can just be, because before I was doing it in a spare bedroom at home, like a lot of YouTubers do. And that was great, but I got to the point where I needed space for the bikes, and it meant I can edit in that space as well. So it kind of worked.
Yeah. The thing as well that I really notice is the quality of videos is always maintained, and it must be so easy to think, oh, do you know what? I'll make one video with the GoPro and just quickly self-shoot something and just chuck it out there just so there's another video out this week. How difficult has it been to just ensure that every video you put out is high quality?
It's pretty difficult, to be honest with you. And I think one of the reasons I chose to do it like that is because people are going to watch content because they there's some perceived value in it for them. So I'm not the best rider in the world, so I can't do any tricks or anything. I can't do big jumps, or people aren't going to watch for the riding. But maybe they'll watch if I can make it look quite appealing. So if I can bring some kind of visual quality that people can appreciate, maybe they'll watch for that, because they're not going to watch for my riding, let's be honest. So I thought, okay, well, yeah, I can do that. I can focus on lighting, and I can focus on what time of day do we go out? When don't we go out? When do we get some bike shots? When do we get creative with some of the angles that we get? So I spent a lot of time trying to work all that out. And for each bike video we do, it's crazy, man. The amount of hours for a 12-minute video, it's like 100, it's over 100 hours when you add it up.
Wow.
For a 12-minute video. It's nuts, isn't it, really? But you don't see what you don't see. So you don't see all the stuff that went wrong.
Yeah.
You don't see all the missed focus shots, or you don't see like the 70% of footage that we don't use because it's just not good. So we shoot like maybe 3 to 4 days. Which is, I don't know. I don't actually know. Maybe you can tell me, because you've done shoots for, maybe you don't need to share if you don't feel comfortable, but I think we shoot a lot of content for not a lot of output, but that's kind of what I feel we need.
I've spent a lot of time shooting, particularly drone content, that I think I got the most incredible shot and then it just doesn't get used. And I used to find it pretty uncomfortable whenever that happened. And I'd often phone the editor and say, like, what's happening? Why didn't you use that shot? Like, I just didn't fit in. And you know that it will never see the light of day. And you must have so many incredible shots that just nobody would ever see.
Yeah. And I think with YouTube, you just can't repeat content either. Some stuff I film a couple of times and you can still have good shots, but there's no point adding them in because the viewer's already seen that shot. There's no point adding it in again. So yeah, but I really enjoy that part of the process. I really enjoy making it look as good as possible. And I like it when people add a comment in and they say, oh, that video looks super good. That environment, that forest looks amazing.
Yeah.
So I think people do see it and appreciate it. So yeah.
How often are you now shooting with social media in mind as well? Because originally I assumed that majority of your focus was YouTube, but now it seems like shorts and reels are becoming more and more important. And I see some of your reels gain massive amount of traction. Is that a factor when you're out shooting?
Not. It's becoming more of a factor because it is so important. I look at how my kids consume media, and it's all kind of TikTok and Instagram reels. So that is massive, really. So I definitely am thinking, how can we make a reel out of this? How can I add something to so when you're swiping on Instagram, you'll be like, oh, what's that? That looks cool. So yeah, some of the reels I've made some specific shorts. I've been like, right, this week I'm going to make some shorts, or today I'm going to spend all day making shorts. And it's actually quite a nice change, because it's a different style of shooting. You're thinking, okay, I need to make this punchy. This short's going to be 30 seconds rather than a 15 minute video. So it's actually it's quite nice to have that kind of different piece of content you're creating and different audience you're looking for. And I think I did a couple. I think the first one I did that I was like, oh, this is cool, people watch this weird stuff, was I got a tire and I put it on the floor and showed how sticky it was. And I kind of showed, I think the caption was, wish your tires were this sticky, ? And it was a Michelin Wild Enduro sticking on the floor and me lifting it up. And it had like 3 million views. I was like, well, that's, people are interested in this weird stuff. So I did a few more of those and that kind of style, and saw that people like watching that stuff. And I made a few more. So I think some of the build ones that I've cut down have had like mega amount of views. So
yeah, let's talk numbers. Can you think of any that have really stood out that have just taken off? What numbers have they done?
Real wise, yeah, I did. I made some stupid ones for PTs where I got a flat tire and rode over a nail, and they were just like goofy shorts, really. And I think that one had, I think it had, when I last looked, I think it had 32 million views. Of me riding over a nail and pulling it out and plugging it and pumping it up.
The thing that really I sometimes think about when I see it, something gets that many views, is put that many people in a stadium or like just in front of you on a hill. It's to think that many people have seen
it. I wonder about how much of people's time that I've wasted with something like that. But yeah, that was 30, I think it was, and that was just on YouTube. That wasn't on Instagram. It probably had, I don't know, another few million on Instagram. But that generated like loads of subscriber growth. So that's people that won't be searching for e-bikes at all, and it just appears in their feed. So it's actually pretty good for growth for the channel as well.
I mean, YouTube channel growth is something that really, like, for you, it seems to, the curve hasn't flattened yet. It actually seems to be steepening. Have you been surprised at just how much growth you've had, even in the past year?
Yeah, I think to get the first 1,000 is so tough, and then to get the 10,000, 100,000, it gets slightly easier each level, because it's like this snowball effect. It starts, your content reaches a bit of a wider audience, and you know, right place, right time, e-bike growth is pretty big. So people, I think, are more and more interested in e-bikes. But yeah, over the past year, I can't remember the numbers, but I think I hit 100,000 maybe last year, or maybe, yeah, I can't remember the exact date. But now it's, some days the subscriber growth is really big. I'm super surprised.
340,000 now.
Is it?
I think something like that. 341. Probably if you watch this, by the time you watch this, it'll be 350 something.
Yeah, I think so. I think I checked and it was 330 or something. But it's, it's been great to see. It's been great to see that people are still interested in it, and there's growth, and more people are watching the videos. And it kind of motivates me to try and make better content. So I try and make every single video better in some way than the last one. And I think it's very marginal, but you start to learn what works and what doesn't work. And you can look at the analytics on YouTube and look at, like, how long do people watch videos for? Okay, why did they drop off there? Okay, let's not do that thing again. Let's do something different. But the growth's been cool, man. I'm super happy with how many people are saying they want to watch content that I make.
I know that YouTube used to be pretty reliant on you uploading on a almost daily basis. Maybe you can tell me more about it, but it seems like now you can get away with uploading a video maybe just once every couple of weeks.
Yeah. Yeah, I used to try and do one a week, but I found that actually I don't think it matters so much. I think, look at, there's a guy called Mark Rober. you might have seen is some of his videos. He's done some of the most popular ones. He's made a glitter bomb where people have stolen packages from doorsteps in America. And they normally come out around about Christmas time. Yeah. And it'll be like a HomePod package and it'll be on a doorstep and it'll wait for the thief to go and steal it. And inside is loads of cameras. Yeah. And there's a glitter bomb that goes off. And it, each year this gets better and better. But he only does one a month, one video a month. And he's got like many millions of subscribers. So there's examples out there that can kind of show that you don't need to do one a week, but there are people that do one a week. So I just think that the overriding factor is to make a video that's good.
Yeah.
And YouTube will serve that to people because it's a good video and people want to watch it. Mm. You could make one a week and they'd be, you know, not that great. And I don't think you would get much growth because people just aren't interested in it. Yeah. Or you could do one a month that's excellent and you can definitely grow the channel that way.
Do you have to write articles as well as upload the video and create the social media content? Is there a whole package that you create that's for the benefit of the brand that you're working for? Or does the relationship differ depending on what brand you work for?
Most of the brands just want a YouTube video. So in fact, that's primarily what we do. So a brand will say, hey, we've got this bike coming out. We'd love you to make a video on it. And then from that, I will do some short form content, some reels, some Instagram stuff as well. And for the EMTB forums, I have some contributors that do like written content, and they're like freelancers basically. Mm. Yeah, because I'm not great at writing, I haven't got the patience really, and I'm not great at articulating written content very well. So
I don't know. I when I watch some of your videos, I think some of them are very well written.
It's the power of editing, man. I can
AI.
Yeah. I have used ChatGPT to transcribe some of the videos that I've created and create an article from it, which is actually really interesting. So I can paste in the entire YouTube transcript and I can say to ChatGPT, create an article and remove anything that doesn't work for written content. So it will remove things like, let me show you this here, because that doesn't translate to a written article because it's visual. So it's an amazing tool. It's an amazing tool to assist you.
Do you think AI will become a bigger part of your content creating life? You've already got it in that new camera that it changes the focus depending on whether there's more than one person in the shot. So
yeah.
It's hard to know whether it's going to affect us or not, but most people seem to be of the opinion that it will.
It's actually, I do use ChatGPT quite a bit for, I've actually used it for analysing YouTube analytics. It's amazing at that.
Yeah.
You can download a massive spreadsheet that's just full of numbers and you can actually upload it to ChatGPT and it will pull out some highlights in that data. So it's actually quite useful. I think I've used it for... I might have even used it to help me create a video title as well.
Yeah.
I think if I've had something in my mind that's quite long, and I'm like, that's too long to be a title, I've put it into ChatGPT and said, can you shorten this into an effective YouTube title? And I don't think I used what it output exactly, but I think I used it as that works. I'll just change that word around, and that's much better than my original one. So, man, AI is like, mega. It's mega. I mean, look at it. It's in bikes already.
Yeah.
The new SRAM kind of Brose collab motor. It's got software on it, and it's analyzing your cadence. I'm sure in the future, it's going to be on a different level to what it is now as well.
Let's talk future tech. What are the areas of the e-bike industry that you think are yet to develop, and where do you think that e-bike tech is going?
I think the whole UI needs to be better. So the integration between the controls, the motor, the software, it's much better than it was, but it's still quite clunky in some regards. So let me give you a specific example. If I want to go and do a route that I'm not familiar with and I see a route online, I want to go and ride that. There's not really an easy way to get that mapped onto my phone. when you go on a journey on your car, you might put it onto your sat nav, Google Maps or whatever, and it works just pretty flawlessly all the time, usually. But when it comes to mapping on an e-bike, I have to do this really weird technique to get it onto my watch or my Garmin. And then I've got a Garmin on my e-bike that's already got a screen. And it's just quite a clunky experience. I have to download it onto my, I think I download it onto my laptop and then upload it onto the Garmin via GPX. And then I'm looking down at my bike and I'm like, why have I got this Bosch screen here and a Garmin? And there's got to be a better way, right?
Yeah.
So I think that there's all of that stuff that can be much better. So I would love it if I can just pick up my e-bike, on my e-bike, find local routes from maybe, I don't know, Trail Forks or something like that, and click do route, and it has a proper decent live map that's gonna show me the route. And then when I get back, it's just gonna send it all to Strava, and it's gonna show me my power input, it's gonna tell me how much battery I use, give me Strava segments maybe. But there's much better ways of doing it than I think what we've got now. So
yeah.
I'm looking forward to that.
Battery tech, that's another area that seems to be developing fast. And we've had the development of the lightweight e-bikes, semi-skimmed e-bikes, as I like to call them. And then the full fat bikes as well, the batteries are growing. I wouldn't say they're necessarily getting any lighter at the moment, but it does seem like battery density is something which is starting to improve. Do you think that there's going to be what area of the e-bike industry do you think will grow? Will the lightweight area start to overtake the full fat e-bikes?
I don't think so. I think the full fat is where the lion's share is. I think that looking at what's on the market, certainly now, if you're looking at buying an e-bike, there's lots available, but I see there's more lightweight e-bikes that are on sale than full fat e-bikes. So that leads me to believe that the market's not as big right now. And I think personally, if I'm going to have an e-bike, I just want all the power and a big battery, especially if you're doing some big climbs. There's definitely a market for lightweight e-bikes and they're great. I think I really enjoy riding lightweight e-bikes, but I just see that the full fat is you know, where the lion's share of the market is. Full fat e-bikes, really, it's the battery that weighs a ton more, because the motors, a lightweight e-bike motor is like 2 kgs and a full power is like 2.7 kgs, one of the lighter ones. So it's only like a water bottle heavier.
Yeah.
So it's not massive, but the batteries are massively heavier. So the Bosch battery is like 4.4 kilos and the TQ battery is like 1.85 kilos or something. So that's where the lightweight comes in, the batteries. The tech is getting better. So the SRAM bike, not the SRAM bike, the propane bike with the SRAM motor, SRAM have produced a more energy dense battery. So the 630 watt hour battery now weighs just over 3 kilos, which is pretty light. Like the energy density for the kilogram is on the higher end. So I think if we can see more of those, I think that that would be a good thing. I also think that in a lot of examples, riding downhill, the full power e-bike is actually better. I think I'm faster on a full fat e-bike on some of the downhill trails than I am on a lightweight e-bike, because the weight just lends itself to going down. So definitely has a different feel in the ride. But for me, I see the full fat still. Maybe there's like a modular battery that might work. So if you want a lighter weight feeling ride, you can get maybe you get it in segments, like blocks of 250, and you're like, okay, I'm going to put three in because today's a big ride, or
yeah
maybe something like that. But yeah, I just full fat, man, it's the way forward.
I agree. I mean, the one thing that has stood out to me with lightweight bikes, so those with like really quiet motors, Trek Fuel EXE is one that stood out for me. I mean, when I first rode that, I just couldn't believe it. It made me realize that I'd just grown to accept the whining noise of an e-bike motor, and then to jump on that and to just have almost silence, it was mind blowing. And if they could bring that to the world of full fat e-bikes, I think that to me is then
they've got to. I think they should be able to upscale that motor. Yeah. That TQ motor. Yeah, I don't see like technically why you can't upsize that motor. It's you do get used to like the noise of a bike, but it doesn't mean it's good or okay.
Yeah.
Like the Bosch motor rattles, so does the Shimano. And then when you get on a Brose motor, it's so silent going downhill. You're like, this is really nice. Mm. But yeah, I think we'll see some improvements in that over the years. I think that the noise going up and the noise, especially the noise going down, will improve because they do make a lot of noise, don't they?
They do, yeah. And I know, especially if you go from a regular mountain bike and then jump on an e-bike, especially some of the more rattly ones, should we say, it is quite shocking actually just how much noise there is underneath you. Mm. But you do adjust to it.
Yeah, you do. You kind of filter it out. Yeah. And it's just like for me, if I'm riding a Bosch motor, I can't hear it as much.
Yeah.
I can hear it when I'm watching it back on the video. I'm like, that's really noisy. But yeah, you do filter it out, but it's not until you get to a nice quiet bike you can really appreciate it. Like the Fuel EXE going downhill, all you can hear is the tires and the dirt. It's a real nice kind of riding experience. Mm. And the same with that SRAM motor, actually. Going downhill on that, it's so quiet. They've done a really good job. I mean, that motor's been around for a while, so the Levo and the Knievo have that Brose motor. So they both of those are quiet going downhill.
Yeah.
But going uphill, it's quite noisy, especially when it's a long uphill. They can kind of get that low hum noise.
Yeah.
So it's quiet going down, but it's loud going up.
Let's talk auto shift. I mean, we're starting to see a development of a couple of brands which are bringing in the auto shift technology. I guess you've spent a bit of time on them now. Is it the future, auto shift?
It's definitely a part there that I think is the future. Yeah. Think about your car. If you've got a manual car versus an auto car, auto cars, they just take a little bit of that thing you need to do away from driving, and it can be a benefit in many situations. Not all of them, but in many situations like motorway driving, it's a massive benefit. Pulling away from lights, slowing down, it always being in the right gear, you not having to manually change gear. Why wouldn't you want that? I don't know, personally, I'd always want that if that's an option. And I see some of that being replicated on the biking side, getting towards the bottom of a trail and being in the right gear, not having to, we've all been there, you pick the bike up, spin it round, try and get it in the right gear, mud flicks everywhere, and you're just kind of used to doing that. But it's really nice getting to the bottom of the trail and not having to do that, or pedaling up, and it's only a micro decision. It's a very small thing you have to think about, and we do it automatically because you've been doing it for years. But when you don't have to do that, it's pretty cool. I don't think it's there just yet for all the situations, like climbing a techie rock garden. You don't really want it to be changing gear at the wrong time. So with the SRAM thing, I kind of used it as a bit of a hybrid. I would shift, because you can always override it. So I would shift when I saw something coming up that it can't see, because it's only reacting. It's only basing its change decision on what's happening in the moment. Whereas your eyes can see a super steep bit of rock that you need to climb, and it can't see that. So you want to be in the right gear before you hit that rather than when you're hitting it.
Yes.
So I think that it's of benefit, definitely. But I think that as a rider, you're always going to want that manual ability to change gears as well. So I think as a hybrid solution, it's really good. I'm not sure it'll ever be able to get there and do it all in the moment, unless it's predicting what's coming up. Maybe AI will, on a map, will somehow be able to predict
camera
what's coming up.
Out front, maybe, having a camera.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Mm.
Yeah.
A bit like a car when it just analyzes the area around it.
Yeah, yeah, it can see what's coming up. But dude, it's really good. It's super cool tech. And in that video that I did, a lot of people appreciate it, but a lot of people are like, oh, why would, that's junk, why would I want that? But the way I see it is the tech's getting better all the time.
Yeah.
And I love this because it motivates other companies, like whoever else is making motors, to think a bit different and think, okay, well, Brose and SRAM have got auto shift. What can we do? How can we make our product compete or better? So I think it's great. I think it's great for e-biking and the industry.
All the wireless shifting now as well, like the pods that you've got on the SRAM system, it makes for such a clean cockpit. Mm. That's one thing that I really like to see developed. More brands need to spend time cleaning up the cockpit, definitely.
Yeah. Less clutter.
Even when it comes to just servicing the bike, like when you've got cables that are coming in through the headset, and I mean, you know, probably as much as well as anyone, that can just be so much more work than just simply changing the bearings on a headset.
Yeah. I don't mind that, to be honest with you, the cables through the headset, personally. And no. I've built some bikes. It is harder. Like, it is more involved with the cables through the headsets. But how often do you change that headset bearing? Yeah. Like, how often do you actually change it?
Depends on the bike brand.
But you're not doing it that often, are you?
No.
Once every 6 months? It's
not even.
There you go. So I think, for me, I don't mind those headset, like those clean cables through the headset. It would definitely not put me off buying a bike.
Yeah.
And that's, I've built bikes with it and changed forks and changed brakes on bikes that have it. So I've got experience, and it's definitely harder. But it looks super clean, man. Yeah. It's like, it looks so good. I think the Orbea Wild has it.
Yeah.
That looks really clean. The Propane has it. A few other bikes. And I just think it looks real cool.
Yeah. A point I forgot to touch on earlier. Full fat bikes and weight. Where do you think is the optimum weight for a full fat bike? Because so we've seen some brands that are bringing them out close to sort of 21 kilos, and then others which are still happy to send bikes out which are 25 plus.
Yeah.
Where do you think is the sweet spot?
I'm riding a bike right now that's 25 kilos, and it feels amazing to ride. So good. I think the geometry and the suspension are more important than 21 versus 25, because that bike is so nice to ride, and the suspension performance on it is amazing. It's a Privateer, by the way, the Privateer E161, and it's heavy bikes, aluminium. It's like they've not spent money on areas that don't need money spending on it. Like, it's got aluminium wheels, it's got parts that are more performance based than weight based, and it rides amazingly well. It rides better than some e-bikes that are 21 or 22 kilos. And I think to get to that 21, what's the lightest full fat? Probably the Orbea Wild at the moment.
I think so.
My version of that was 22.5 once you've put like proper tires on it. So let's say that's the benchmark now, full power with a big battery, 22.5 in an XL for my size with proper tires. The Privateer is full aluminium, and that's 25. So we're talking 2.5 kilo difference between maybe the top end and a slightly heavier one. I don't think there's anything in that at all in terms of what it will perform like on a trail.
Yeah,
there's nothing in it. I think a 21 kilo bike full power right now is too many compromises. It will have lightweight tires, maybe super light carbon rims that you can crack, and I've cracked some carbon rims. I am not bothered, really. But I think some of it gets down to, I'm 6'3", and I'm like, you know, not the lightest person. So for me, it's a smaller bike weight to body weight ratio.
Yeah.
But for somebody that's maybe lighter, let's say, for example, someone weighs 70 kilos, a 25 kilo e-bike is higher in proportion to their, so they may have more benefits to somebody that can appreciate a lighter weight. But yeah. Even the super light bikes, when I build them to a spec that I like, they do end up weighing about 19 kilos. So
not far off.
It's not far off. So I'm, 20. If a bike's between 23 and 25 kilos, they are absolutely fine. Mm. And I don't see any benefits, really. Like the Privateer, if I took that from 25 kilos to 23, I'd probably have to spend, I don't know, £3,000 on it, maybe £2,000 to £3,000, carbon wheels, carbon bars, lightweight stuff, and it might be worse than what it is now. Like, I don't know, what maybe lifting up over gates might be a bit easier.
Yeah,
lifting it into vans, but I'm not sure it'd be a better bike. Yeah,
I'm all for aluminium frames as well. I think alloy frames that to me is actually the future of e-bikes, because I think it's more sustainable. You can want, well, there's a lot more to say about the recycling aspect of e-bikes, which is probably a bigger conversation that we need to have. But with a carbon e-bike frame, that's always going to be a carbon e-bike frame. It's not got another purpose. Whereas for me, alloy is a more sustainable thing to use. And I don't think it's any lesser a product than using carbon personally. And like you say, the weight differences now probably not that great.
No, I don't think there's any weight benefit. Well, the carbon is lighter. It's a fact. It's the equivalent carbon frame is lighter, but it's not much lighter. And I don't think it's going to make any difference, really, in the difference that you're going to feel in the performance between having one that's made out of carbon and an identical frame made out of aluminium. Carbon, that arguably you can make some more complex shapes out of carbon, like different linkages and things. But some of my favorite e-bikes are aluminium, like the Privateer. I'm talking about them now because I've got it. I've got it as a demo bike. That's aluminium. The Pole, Voima, aluminium, CNC machined, an amazing performing bike. So, yeah, I agree. I think there's definitely carbon is an area of the industry that not brands don't really focus on what's going to happen to that bike when it's reached the end of its life. No. How can we get it back, and how can we help with the recycling process? There are brands that are doing some good work, like Trek have done some sustainability studies. And I think the, I guess we'll call it the dirtiest bike in like carbon emissions or net carbon that it introduces to the atmosphere is an e-bike. And they've been open and honest about it. So like the Trek Rail adds X amount of carbon versus an aluminium hardtail. It's pretty much high. It's quite a bit higher. Yeah. But it's good that brands are starting to look at that. But yeah, I some of it I think is, I think there's some responsibility on, you know, people like myself to maybe highlight that at some point, because I'm definitely thinking about the impact of it. But sometimes I get a carbon bike and I'm like, that's sick, man. That bike looks so good. And, you know, it's not good, but the bike looks amazing. But actually, there's what's going to happen to that bike in 10 years? Where's that frame going to be? How can that be recycled? Whereas an aluminium bike is infinitely recyclable.
Yes.
So I think some of it is just consumers. The brands may say consumers want carbon bikes, and we probably do. We like carbon bikes. We like the way they ride, the way they look. So the market is demanding it at the moment. But I do think there's definitely opportunities for some more awareness into what will happen with that product in the future. Where's it going to go?
Question is the customer always right?
Yeah, well, if you come from a retail background, yes.
Let's move on to quick fire questions. Let's see how quick we can make it. Favorite trail?
Oh, man. Favorite trail, maybe trail area, if that's okay.
Yeah,
because I really like riding in the Surrey Hills, and I've ridden in some amazing places, but the Surrey Hills is such an amazing place to ride because there's lots of short, sharp trails. There's not a huge amount of elevation there at all, but every time I go there and we ride with mates, it's we have such an amazing time.
This quick fire question round.
Sorry.
Isn't
going very well. I was trying to add some justification to my answer, because sometimes I'll go on a trip and there'll be like people there that'll say, oh, I've heard of the Surrey Hills. It sounds amazing. And we're in like Verbier or something. Like, dude, this is really good here too.
Yeah.
So I just like it because every time we go there, we have a good time.
Verbier is awesome though.
Yeah. There's some amazing trails there.
Favorite country?
To ride?
Yeah.
I liked South Africa.
Yeah.
There's some trails in and around. Where do we go? Oh, there's some trail area around Yonkershok, I think it is.
Okay.
It's amazing. Amazing scenery. And
next one was going to be burger or steak, but you don't eat meat.
No, I don't. But you can get some good veggie burgers.
Yeah. Genuinely. All right, tofu or seitan? Do you ever eat seitan?
Seitan. I think I've had it before. It's like a textured...
It's like sort of chickeny sort of texture.
Tofu's really bland, so I'll go with that one.
Okay. If you had one meal for the rest of your life, what would it be?
Probably some kind of pasta dish.
Yeah.
Boring. Or I do eat a lot of, muesli.
Yeah.
Because that's, I just find it like, you get loads of, it's got oats and stuff in and sweet stuff. So probably, maybe that.
Good shout, yeah. Beach holiday or mountain holiday?
I do a lot of beach holidays because that's what my family really like, and I don't mind it at all. It's pretty nice to go for a beach holiday, but I'd love to do more mountain holidays. Mm. Yeah.
Most famous person you've ever met?
Yeah, this isn't that quick fire, is it? Not really. I don't think I've met many famous people.
You know, just stumbled into one in the past.
No, don't think so.
What about in the bike industry?
Sam Pilgrim, Ollie Wilkins.
Yeah.
Obviously the guys from GMBN, EMBN. Who else? Yeah, most of the people you see on YouTube, I think I've bumped into at some event or something.
Dream dinner guest. You can have dead or alive.
Oh, okay.
I mean, they would be alive when they're at the dinner.
Yeah. I don't know about dinner guests, but somebody I would have really have liked to meet would have been Steve Jobs.
Yeah.
Just because his intense like passion for what he did and tech and you know, visions for the future. I think he would have been an amazing person to have a conversation with about just that and life in general, and about, yeah, his dedication to what he did was pretty amazing.
Let's go back to bikes.
Yeah.
You might struggle with this one. Best premium e-bike.
Best premium e-bike.
Talking high end.
Like high end, I think they're all like, they're all pretty premium. Like they're all quite expensive, but like boutique high end.
Yeah.
I love the Crestline and I love the Pole Voima. They're two like long travel e-bikes there. Yeah. I think the company, the people that run them are so passionate about what they do, and the bikes are sick, man. They're super, like super bikes, really.
Those crest lines look stunning.
Yeah.
Yeah. Lovely build.
Yeah.
Okay. Best budget e-bike.
Oh, Vitus, man. That new Vitus e-Mythique is nuts.
Yeah.
It's so good.
I just had a spin on it and on the one you've got at the moment, and I can't believe that motor. It's just... It feels like a bros motor. It just takes off.
Yeah, yeah. What you get for your money is amazing. I think, like, I'll compare it to the Canyon Strive-On, for example. That bike that I ride is, I can't remember the price. Let's say it's $6,000. The Vitus currently, the deal is insane because they're doing 30% off of it. But even at the regular price, I think it's like half the price of the Canyon. But it's like at least 80% to 90% as good. It's not, the suspension's not as good because it's using more budget stuff. The components are you know, a bit more entry level, but the geometry and the way it rides is amazing. So they've done a, sorry, this is not quick fire, I'm elaborating a bit more on my answer, but yeah, that bike is, for what they've got for the money, it's amazing.
The next one's going to be lightweight or full fat, but I think we've already answered that one, haven't we?
I do appreciate the lightweight bikes. And I do really enjoy riding them, but my personal choice for what I do, because we do a lot of group riding, if I was on a lightweight, I'd be like left for dead.
I actually think a lightweight suits a lighter rider best.
Yeah.
At the moment. I don't know. Maybe people disagree with that. SRAM or Shimano?
I think SRAM right now are charging ahead with tech. I look at, like, I've been a big fan of Shimano in the past for the shifting quality. Shifting under load with the Hyperglide Plus has been amazing. But since SRAM brought out their transmission, I think the shifting is as good, if not better. And it's wireless and it's clean and their wireless tech just works. And SRAM are doing loads, but Shimano stuff's great as well.
It's 2023 right now. What is the best motor?
My... out of all of them, I like the Bosch the best because of the punchiness and the power delivery. It's super responsive and really quick, especially for like techie climbs. And yeah, it's definitely not perfect. And there are other motors that are better than it in other areas. But for what I like to ride, I like the punchiness and the instant response that you get from the Bosch motor. And it's powerful.
Mm. Car or van?
Oh, well, I've recently gone from a van to a car. So I'm going to say car with a bike rack on the back.
Which is, not many people would say that in the bike world, would they?
No. The van is super versatile. You can chuck anything in the back and it's secure. If you pull up to a petrol station, you haven't got an e-bike on the back and you're not so worried about the van being broken into. Whereas if it's on a rack, I'm always concerned that the bike's on the back. But cars drive much nicer than vans. They pretty economical compared to a van. And with a rack, like I've got one of these Thule racks, it's actually, I think, quicker to put it on the rack rather than it was to dismantle the front wheel and put it into my van. Mm. And it's stable. I was a little bit lazy with my van in that sometimes I would just chuck the bike in and I'll go around a corner.
I hate that.
It would fall over. Whereas with the rack, it's like super secure. Mm.
Facebook or Instagram or TikTok?
No, Instagram.
Yeah.
For me, yeah. It's just, yeah, Facebook I find quite clunky to use still.
Is TikTok the future?
Probably. Mm. Yeah, probably.
How long till you go to the dark side?
I have got an account on there, but I can't be bothered to update it. I think that a lot of my audience is on Instagram right now, and probably I should do more on TikTok, but yeah, I don't.
Perhaps when those younger TikTok users start to think about buying their first e-bike, that's when you need to start making the
change. I definitely need to. Maybe that'll be my next thing that I do more on. Yeah.
TikTok star.
Yeah, it's just time. It's like, yeah. Maybe I could just cross-post the stuff that I post on Instagram onto TikTok as a start.
A lot of people do that, I think.
Yeah.
It's quite common. Is there anything else that we haven't covered?
Don't think so.
Done most bases,
haven't we? cover quite a lot.
Yes. Well, I definitely would like to talk to you again because I think there's a lot of areas of the e-bike industry that we've still not touched, and the tech is changing so fast. So I could speak to you in a year's time.
Yeah, man. We'll have self-driving bikes, and it won't need to do anything. It'll shift for you, and there'll be a little foot that comes out and pedals it around for you as well.
We'll be sat on the sofa with a headset on, and we'll just
go for a VR ride.
Yeah, together. Okay, it's been cool. Thank you very much for coming on the podcast. I guess finally, most people probably already know, but where can people find you?
YouTube, Rob Rides EMTB, and same on Instagram.
Happy days.
Cheers,
buddy.
Mate. Nice Thank one. You.